From Wrestling Observer headquarters, it's Wrestling Observer Radio. It's Friday evening, August 10th. I'm Garrett Gonzalez alongside Dave Meltzer. What's going on, Dave?
I don't know. You tell me what's going on. We got tons of stuff to talk about tonight.
Yes, we have got a ton to get into. By the way, this is a free show, so welcome aboard to those of you who are listening for the first time. I've been a subscriber to this website since just about the very beginning, and I've also been subscribing to The Observer since 2000. So I'm proof that this website is quite the deal. Dave and Brian are going to do another show after the G1 finale on Sunday. So if you like what you hear, go ahead to WrestlingObserver.com and subscribe. I was just talking to Brian today, and he said there are over 9,000 hours of audio on the website. Shows like Brian and Vinny, Brian and Filthy Tom, Left My Wallet.
Filthy Tom Lawler.
Josh Nason's Punch Out, and of course this show, which usually features Brian and Dave. And of course, there are the newsletters, Figure Four and Wrestling Observer. Dave's Observers go all the way back to 1988, but really pick up in 91. And the current back issue that just went up is from July with the death of Terry Gordy. And the current issue features a WWE Business Review, the story on Conor versus Khabib, G1 Supercard News, and of course the past week of the G1 analysis. And we just did the math. There are over 1,000 issues of The Observer on the website.
Yeah, wow. I wonder if I'm going to get to, well, I'm going to get to 2,000. I don't know if I'm going to get how much longer I'm going to get after that, though.
That's a lot of writing.
It's a lot of writing. Yeah, well, I think I've written more than Brian said more than anyone, but I think they found someone who actually has written more than me in the world, but maybe only one person.
How is that even possible?
I don't know.
Okay, so let's get going. I guess maybe the biggest news of the last couple days is the Ring of Honor New Japan G1 Supercard event not only sold out, but was among the quickest sellouts for a pro wrestling event in the history of Madison Square Garden.
I think it would be the quickest, except for maybe WrestleMania's. I can't imagine that anything else sold out. I mean, because this was – it was – I've heard two numbers, and actually the people at Ring of Honor said it was between 13 and 19 minutes as far as once it went on sale to the public, which is misleading because it was 2 days of, you know, Honor Club sales and things like that, and they sold 12,000 tickets before. But, you know, when WWE or anyone talks about 9-minute sellouts, it's the same gimmick. You know what I mean? Nobody, you know, the only people who really sell out in like, you know, 5 minutes or PWG, and that's because it's 600 tickets. Nobody else does that. So it's one. Yeah. So except for, I think it sold out quicker than the first WrestleMania. I don't think it sold out quicker than WrestleMania 10, but I'd have to look that up. Was it? Yeah. 10 or 20. I'm not sure. 20 sold out pretty quick. Is 20 at the Garden?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 20 sold out pretty quick. And I don't remember how quick 10 sold out, but I doubt it sold out in 13 minutes because people didn't buy advance tickets that way, you know that far back, you know, as quick as they do now.
Yeah, and you guys have talked about this before, but the key Bullet Club elite talent aren't signed through when that show takes place, which puts them in a pretty nice leverage spot.
Yeah, everything changed with this sellout because I always thought that for them, the way to play the game is to, no matter what, get your Madison Square Garden sellout, which would be do, you know, even if it means signing a 6-month extension in January through June or whatever it is, maybe 5-month extension or something like that. And then, but you get your sellout, and then right after your sellout, when you're the hottest that you're going to be, then you go to the open market, and whether you stay or whether you go, whatever, you know, I mean, that's to be determined. Okay. But that's the time. That's the right time, right? We talk about it with basketball players and everything about, mm-hmm. It's all about timing. You go after your, you know, if you have a great NBA playoffs or if you're a fighter and you win a big fight, you know what I mean? And this one, the Garden, essentially, is one of the biggest things that they could possibly do, maybe the biggest in the United States, just because of the nature of everything. And we pretty much knew this Garden was going to sell out. I mean, from day one. We didn't know it was going to sell out this quick. Because it sold out this quick, it changes the entire dynamic. They've already got, I mean, they'll have to do the show to perform on their Garden sellout, but they already got their Garden sellout. their leverage is there. I mean, it's probably bigger now because Vince doesn't want him on that show. So, and then Vince has to show head to head the same night, which is, it's an incredible leverage. And, what was really interesting was, you know, Greg Gilliland, quotes, you know, about that. Do you have that in front of you?
Yeah. He said, quote, the question was about the talent. He said, of course, we're going to do everything we can to keep them, and we have fair offers and fair plans to retain them. With that said, I don't think we ever operate in fear. We always operate with solid backup plans. We always have to think about what if this and what if that. If they go to WWE and they very much deserve that opportunity, we'll continue to offer the best wrestling that we can. There's other talent out there. We will continue our brand. We will continue as our brand has for the past however many years. We've lost top guys before. And basically he said the ROH brand is about the ROH experience, and that's how we continue to grow. That statement had a few interesting things in it, and especially the part where he said that that they've lost guys before.
Well, they have.
True.
I mean, ROH was, you know, when ROH started, you know, when Gabe Sapolsky was booker, I mean, he and I would talk about it. It's like, it was designed. You didn't want guys around for more than a couple of years. The idea was you did them, and then it was time for them to go, whether it was WWE or and that, you know, in those days, Impact also, right? But it wasn't, you know, the idea of the Briscoes or people like that are there for a whole career, that wasn't what it was supposed to be. Now it's changed. You know, it is you know, before it was a place where it was your final place to go, where you have your great matches, you make your name underground before you make your name big time on television. And, you know, you're not making big money there. Well, now there's guys who are making big money there. But those guys, you know, they want bigger money.
Yeah.
And there's no reason not to, you know. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. So it becomes a situation where, from a Ring of Honor standpoint, this is Sinclair. Sinclair's got the thing in an interesting position. I mean, Ring of Honor, realistically, in the last year, got bigger than anyone ever expected it would get, as far as the ability to draw. I mean, we're talking about a year and a couple of months ago. You know, the WrestleMania in Lakeland, the WrestleMania show in Lakeland, set their all-time attendance record with the Young Bucks and the Hardys in the ladder match. That was 3,500 people, okay? And that was like, you know, the advance was probably 2,000, 2,500. They got the big walk-up because it was WrestleMania week and it was a cool ladder. You know, it was a big match at the time. The Hardys were hot off of the broken gimmick on Impact. The Young Bucks were the top stars on Ring of Honor. They had worked out this long program, but then the Hardys went to WWE, so the whole program got, you know, put on the back burner. It didn't happen the way it was planned to, but they got that big match. So that you know, it was a giant match. It was not a sellout. They were set up for 4,000. So that's where they were. You know, what are we talking about? 14, wait, April, May, June, July, 16 months ago. That's where you were 16 months ago. You know, when basically when I got asked that question about can they draw 10,000 at a show, and at that point they could not. You know, now of course everything's changed, and they sold out Madison Square Garden. They didn't just sell out Madison Square Garden; they sold it out immediately, and with nothing announced, with no special match. They didn't have a Kenny Omega Cody match like this year's WrestleMania, which also didn't sell out, you know, until the week of the show, or roughly a week before the show, I think. So the amount that they have grown, you know, so now Sinclair has to look and go, what do we want to be? The amount, the value of WWE stock, I mean, you know, look at the situation. I mean, this is the analogy that, you know, a lot of people have looked at in the last day, when PFL raised $28 million and, you know, Bellator got the DAZN deal. It's like I believe there's more value and there's more potential in a strong number two pro wrestling product than a strong number two MMA product, let alone a strong number three, let alone a weak number three MMA product. Sinclair, as far as with a business relationship with New Japan, can be that number two. And be a lot stronger. Look how strong they are. You know, you can't deny it, right? So they have to decide, are we going to go all out to be as big as possible, which may mean overpaying guys to keep them because those guys are key to our growth. They're the backbone of the growth. Or do we just keep a low budget and we stay where we are? And if that's the idea that we're going to stay where we are, if they lose these guys, they're not going to be able to go to the Garden again. You know, I mean, it's like I think that that's, you know, how much will they be hurt by losing those guys? If that's to happen, the Young Bucks and Cody, because they're the big regulars, you know, I don't know. And then we also have the question of what happens with Adam Page, who may not quite be there yet, but he's obviously, in the last couple of weeks, he's taken incredible strides. And Marty Scurll, who's a big star, you know, what do they do also? You know, do they go? Do they stay? So it's like, it's Sinclair has to make a decision, and that is, are we going to be going for the idea that a number two wrestling product is going to have great value because of the nature of television going forward and the nature of money for streaming and things like that, and we're going to spend and we're going to lose money, you know, planning to build for the future, or are we just going to be happy with cheap wrestling product with, you know, these guys, in which case they're going to go down. They'll go down next year. They're not going to be able to do the, no, they won't be able to. I don't think, again, I don't know. I don't think without the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega and Cody, that if you brought in Tanahashi, Okada, all the New Japan guys, I don't think you're selling out the Garden next year. I think with everyone, if you have a bang up show, can you come back next year and do it again? Maybe not, but it's certainly worth a try, and maybe you can.
I think Greg, the other thing that popped out in this statement to me, you just mentioned, you know, do they see themselves as, you know, number two or competition? I mean, he out and out says if they go to WWE and they very much deserve that opportunity, doesn't that make it seem like where they believe where they are?
It was an interesting way to say it. I mean, again, he may be, like sometimes you say words and when you read them, you go, oh my God, he said that. And you weren't really thinking that. You're just,
maybe he was just being generous to WWE.
Well, just say they deserve the chance, you know, which, you know, of course that, you know, they deserve the chance. They deserve that spotlight that WWE affords, but is it the best thing for them in the long run? You know, there's so many factors involved in this. You know, I mean, there's a lot to being, you know, they're not their own bosses, but they run their, you know, all of these things that they've done in the last year plus. I mean, that's those guys sitting around coming up with ideas. I mean, the Being the Elite is their show, and that's where all the key angles have been for both. And New Japan lets them do what they want, and Ring of Honor lets them do what they want. And, you know, that's not going to happen in WWE. I think that the Matt Hardy situation is probably, you know, if there's ever an illustration, it's Matt Hardy. I mean, Matt Hardy's, that gimmick was so over, and for a while he couldn't do the gimmick, but now he can do the gimmick, and look where he's at. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, and you know, they could be there too. And it's like, you know, I mean, you know, Matt Hardy, is it the right thing for them? And then, you know, you've got the whole thing. There's so many different things. You know, it's like, you know, they've got kids, which works two ways. You know, one, do you want to be on the road 200 days a year when you have young kids? But at the same time, do you want to make as much money as you can because you got young kids? And the one, you know, there's advantage. There's definitely advantages to WWE, and there's definitely disadvantages to WWE. And the other thing too is, everyone, all those guys got different goals. You know, Kenny Omega, his goal may very well be to be the next Stan Hansen and have a great career in Japan. He lives in Japan. You know, him being in Japan is not a hardship. He loves it. Him being the top guy in Japan is a destination. It's not a stop on the way to a destination. This is his destination. The Young Bucks are happy to go to Japan, but they don't want to live in Japan. They don't want to be doing complete Japan tours. They want to come in and do their three nights at Budokan Hall and then go home to see their family. You know, Kenny's going to be there for the month. It's a big difference. You know, Paige and Marty Scurll have their ideas. Cody's got his ideas. Cody has no kids. Cody wants to book himself. And they've all said it. You know, they may all be in a different place this time, you know, not even this time next year. They may be all being in a different place in March. You know, who knows?
Yeah, and I think the other interesting thing is the way that the market is going right now, where it's all about who's willing to pay for content. I mean, theoretically, a TV station or could just go after those guys and say, you guys start your own thing. We don't even need...
Or maybe a Billy Corgan.
Or Billy Corgan.
Yeah, who's on the, he's involved in the All-In show. I mean, it's no secret Billy Corgan, you know, is trying to get television at some point. He wants to get something going. He's clearly got a relationship because he got his NWA title on that Chicago show, which to me was an incredible coup for him. Because look at Nick Aldis, you know what I mean? It's like his profile's up now and he's on Being the Elite, you know, which is a star making show. So yeah, there's that. You know, maybe somebody starts something, some rich, you know, guy or rich conglomerate or, you know, Mark Cuban, you know what I mean? Maybe somebody doesn't want to start something but wants to partner with New Japan. Maybe they want to partner with Ring of Honor. You know, someone who's in there and going like, hey, number two, if WWE can make, you know, $470 million a year in television rights fees, there's a lot of potential money if you run a good wrestling company. And, you know, you need stars. You can't do wrestling without stars. The idea that it's all about the brand, WWE can get away with that. Nobody else can.
Do you think the WGN Zero Hour is any sort of leading indicator of maybe they'd be interested in something like this?
Well, they're interested. It's a one-shot deal. They don't have a long-term deal. But if that hour does big ratings, you know, will they be interested in something else? Of course they will. It's TV. Especially now when these cable stations are desperate for anything that's going to do an audience. Now, in theory, this hardcore wrestling, and I mean hardcore, I don't mean blood and guts, I mean underground, internet created or social media created wrestling superstars, in theory, that shouldn't do ratings. In theory, of course, it shouldn't sell at Chicago and Madison Square Garden either. So a lot of the theory, and it's, you know, this is what's driving a lot of people in the industry crazy. And, you know, we can't even talk about how crazy some people are, but there are some people who are crazy right, you know, this week. But what's driving them crazy is that all logic is that this is impossible. This is completely impossible. And, you know, and 2 years ago it was. You know, with the All In, by the time they got to All In, you know, I didn't think it was impossible. This one, I knew 100% it wasn't impossible. And, you know, like somebody even did a joke to me about an hour ago and was like, do you think that they can sell a stadium? And I said, I was very careful. I said, not in the next six. I mean, it was actually AT&T Stadium. Do you think they can sell at AT&T Stadium? And I said, not in the next 6 months. So Cody hasn't bet me on that one yet.
Not yet.
Maybe I'll hear from him tomorrow.
Is there anything else, any other angle on the story that you want to hit on before we move on?
No, there's anything else. I think we've hit on the enormity of it. You know, as far as the guys go, anyone who thinks that they know where those guys are going, I don't think the guys know where they're going. I think there's going to be a lot of different offers made, and there's going to have to, you have to, everyone's got to weigh their options. I don't know what's going to happen. Again, the quickness of the sellout changed the dynamic greatly. I don't know. What do you think?
I guess I have one more question about this. You talked about leverage. This is perfect timing for them. I've also seen situations where you have this, you know, this leverage, and it could kind of splinter, like the guys may not be all, you know, all for one and one for all.
Well, I think there's a good chance that's going to happen. The Young Bucks will stay together because they have similar goals and dreams, and they don't want to break up their team. So they're going to stick together. Everybody else, like Omega has his goals. Cody wants to be an actor, too. You know, I mean, you got to put that, you know, that part of the dynamic in. So he's going to want to, Cody's going to want control. And I don't know that he's going to get that in WWE. So I think that, like, he, you know, you never know. I mean, Vince could also go in there and just go, look, this thing's getting too big, and I want everyone. And, you know, if he offers Cody $2 million a year, and I'm just throwing out a number, you know, he probably will get him, you know, at that kind of a number. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that. Vince can afford a number to get everyone if he really wants them bad enough. Will he do that, or will he just, you know, just say, you know, they need to come because this is the place to be. And if they have that attitude, you know, these guys can make money on the outside. It's not, you know, it's not like, and they're not, I don't think any one of them, I don't think there's one of them. You know, again, I don't know what Paige's goals are, but for the most part, if we're talking the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega and Cody, I don't think there's one of them who will be like the guys from the previous generation or the, a lot of the guys where, I'm making 80, they offer me 80, I'm going for sure. Or I'm making 100, they offered me 60, I'm still going. You know what I mean? They're not going to be those guys. Because it's WWE and it's been my goal since I was a kid. I'm going, you know, I mean, Kenny's been through there and he left. You know, the Young Bucks have no need to go, but you know, I mean, that doesn't mean that they have no, I don't think they have an aversion or a fear of going either.
The other story that I wanted to get to before we talk about the G1 is the Colt Cabana CM Punk story. Cabana filed lawsuit against Punk over legal fees from the Dr. Amon defamation suit against them. And the first thing that I thought when I heard this was like, wow, they really are not friends. I thought at some point they were going to become friends again, but this was really surprising to me.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've known, I knew some people, this is way back when, but, they were best friends. There was a car wreck that they were both in. One sued the other. It was an insurance thing and they remained best friends, even though one sued the other. And I thought that's kind of weird. But this is, I don't think this is that case at all, especially reading the lawsuit. You know, if you read the lawsuit, your conclusion is that Punk's a dick, right? I mean, it's just like he had money. He wanted to fight this thing to the end. Cabana figured, you know, he's going to reimburse my legal fees. We'll fight it to the end. The whole reason probably that Cabana was in there was to have one turn on the other, which is Cabana turn on Punk, because they didn't care about Cabana. This whole,
you're talking about WWE, that was their strategy.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, they wanted to, you know, I mean, the perfect analogy is the Martha Hart lawsuit against WWE when you go back, where they had the whole family turning on each other because, you know, WWE, you know, some of them felt they needed WWE, their husbands needed WWE. And you had, you know, it's a really ugly thing, but that's what happens in these situations. So, but you know, like when you read it, you know, that's certainly going to be your conclusion, in the sense that, you know, Punk, you know, Cabana doesn't have a ton of money. I mean, certainly not the level of Punk. The legal bills, you know, $500,000 in legal bills to defend that thing, roughly. So his half was like $250,000, and he doesn't have $250,000 running around. And it really wasn't his fight to have, you know what I mean? He was drug into the fight largely so the WWE and it's, or Amon or Amon's lawyers, whoever you want to say is behind the lawsuit, had someone to turn on Punk, who didn't turn on Punk partially because he felt that he didn't have the economic need to turn on Punk, because the feeling was that if he wasn't, you know, indemnified by Punk, he'd have the economic need. Even if he liked Punk, he'd have no choice but to turn on Punk. He didn't turn on Punk, so that strategy didn't work. But now there's $250,000 in legal bills that he owes. So he's suing Punk over that, with the idea that Punk had promised to you know, he'd promised that he would cover his legal bills, and him claiming that if he didn't think he was his legal bills would be covered, that he, you know, he might have settled, that he would have pulled the show when the first legal threat came. So that's his side of the story. We don't know Punk's side of the story. I know someone close to that situation who all they would tell me is it's not Punk and it's not Cabana. And obviously those two guys aren't going to be talking right now about it in any length other than what's already in that thing. Most likely they're not Jerry Lawler, who talks about everything, no matter what the lawyers tell him to be quiet. You know what I mean? But the point is that that person was sympathetic to Punk's side, not to Cabana's side. But it was one of those things of, you know, it's, I can't tell you more, you know. So what that means, I'm curious. There was obviously a falling out between the two of them before the trial. I don't think that's a secret. I don't know all the situation. I mean, the theory is that Cabana went to a WWE show and Punk, you know, who cut ties with everyone from WWE. That's why, and his wife left the company, because he was cutting ties with everyone in WWE. And I think that Punk thought, out of loyalty or because the fact that he's being sued by WWE, that he shouldn't have gone to the show and talked to the guys or whatever he did. So there was that issue then, but, you know, at the trial, you know, those guys were talking to each other, but, you know, they were on the same side on the trial. You know what I mean? It's like they were either going to win together or they were going to lose together. And they won together, but now's the big legal bill.
And the conflict about the pay, it didn't just happen today. This has been sort of ongoing, right?
It had to have been. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think at the end, the lawsuit is because Punk just wasn't going to pay that other half. And Cabana felt that it should be, Punk should pay it. And he claims had promised to pay it, and that there's different times where he's indicated it, that he would pay it. So, I expect that this one, I expect to be settled. I don't think that, because here's the thing, unless Cabana's lawyers are doing this with the idea that they're going to fund it themselves, Cabana can't afford another lawsuit, you know, that, and Punk doesn't want another lawsuit. Obviously no one does. He just got through with the last one. But he can afford it, whereas Cabana can't. And so unless, you know, Cabana's lawyers are going, this is an easy case, we're going to win, and they're behind, they're, you know what I mean? They're taking on contingency. You know, there's only so long it can go.
Okay, so let's move on to the G1, the A Block finale show. The A Block final show was today. We had Okada, Tanahashi, and Jay White all still up for winning. And Evil played spoiler and beat Jay White, which allowed the main event to be for all the marbles. Okada and Tanahashi went to a 30-minute draw, which allowed Tanahashi to win with 15 points to Okada's 13. What did you think of the match?
Oh, the match was a classic. I don't think it was the best Tanahashi Okada match I've ever seen. I don't think it was as good as the one that they had in May, but it was in other ways. I mean, it was a perfect match. You know, I mean, those two guys. I think that their aspects. I mean, it's funny because there are so many incredible guys that are wrestling right now. Including in the G1, like a dozen of them, it feels like sometimes in the G1, but there's so many incredible guys, but there are ways when it comes to pacing and when it comes to ring psychology and when it comes to getting the most out of every movement that you do, where there's nobody in this business, I would say, at the level, and not even at the level of Tanahashi. And the one who's the closest is Okada. I mean, Kenny Omega is fantastic in a different way. Kenny Omega is more about creativity. You know, it's obviously the explosiveness and the athleticism and the high risks and all that. I mean, Tanahashi, this was an incredible match, and it was totally safe. It was safer than a WWE match. You know, it's dragon screws and a couple of, you know, you get the full Nelson dragon suplex at the end, But, you know, and Tanahashi did the high fly flow to the floor, you know, which, you know, he saves for his big matches. I mean, it's not, you know, safe like a Zack Sabre match, but, you know, it wasn't, nobody was getting busted up, and I was never worried about those guys once in the whole match, which is has not been the case that much. And, you know, in a lot of these great G1 matches, I got that qualm of like, yeah, the match is great, but these guys are ending their careers prematurely. I'm scared for them.
Including the one tomorrow.
Which may be the most dangerous of them all. Yeah, which we'll talk about later. But I, 30-minute draw.
Were you surprised that it went to a draw?
Yes, because they did it the two shows, the last two times they were in G1, which I think were, what years? Was it 2 years ago and 3 years ago, was it? Because last year Okada was with Omega. So it was 2 years ago and 3 years ago, I think, that they did 30-minute draws, as I recall. But, yeah, I didn't expect it. But I'm glad of it because I did think Omega and Ibushi had a good chance of being a 30-minute draw, and I don't believe they're going to do two of them. So now it tells me, and I think that part of it is, and it also tells the fans, not that it matters, but if you're looking at trying to read into Ghetto's booking, you know, you're going to go, you know, there is going to be a winner. You don't know for sure who. Maybe Ibushi, which would be so emotional, because Omega's more expected because he's the champion. But, you know, there's, you know, it depends on, you know, it all depends on destination now. If we go with the, so one of the key points is that Okada has been in the main event championship match. Has he been in the main event championship match every year since 2012 at Wrestle Kingdom? I think so. Well, it wasn't the 1 year, because the 1 year Tanahashi and Nakamura were the main event, that was the Intercontinental title. But, you want to look it up?
I'll look it up while you're talking.
Okay. So, but the thing is based on that result, it does not look like Okada is going to be in the main event this year. And this was after him promising that this year is going to be the year that he sells the place out. You know, so that's a real interesting move. If it is Tanahashi against Omega, just as an example, you know, if it's Tanahashi against Omega, you go with the idea that Tanahashi has to win, and that sets up the logical match at the Tokyo Dome. If it's Tanahashi against Ibushi, which would be an incredible final, well, Tanahashi and Omega is actually, it's not the first time they've wrestled, but I think it's only the second time. And, you know, it's been years. They've never done the big program. They were supposed to do it once, and Tanahashi got hurt right before they did the program. Or right after the first match. They were going to do a ladder match, and then Tanahashi got hurt. And so they've never had the long feud, and Omega's wanted it, and Tanahashi's wanted it too. So it could be that. It could be, you know, Ibushi beating Omega, which could lead to, you know, either of them, Ibushi or Tanahashi, winning the G1 this year, and either one going to the Tokyo Dome against Omega. You know, Omega could lose the title, but I don't think he's going to. I think Omega is headlining the Tokyo Dome this year. I suppose, you know, Okada never beat Omega, so Omega's, you know, matches, if Omega's defenses between now and the end of the year, it's Ishii for sure. And then the other one is if Ibushi beats him and Tanahashi beats Ibushi, he'll defend against Ibushi before the Tokyo Dome. So, you know, that would be the two things. There is a chance of Naito. Do you want to go through the different million possibilities for tonight?
Yeah, go for it.
So, but do you look up as far as?
So, you'd have to go back to Wrestle Kingdom 6, which was Tanahashi and Suzuki.
That's like 2011, right? So he's been in the championship match, not the main event, because there was the year he wasn't in the main event, but it was the championship match, and they put Tanahashi and Nakamura last.
2012 was Wrestle Kingdom 6.
Okay, so that's right, because he debuted. When he came back from TNA in 2012, and then he won the title in March. So 2013 would have been his first Tokyo Dome.
So last six Wrestle Kingdoms.
Six straight champ, yeah. So that breaks that streak. Which, in a way, I'm surprised, because I just thought that, you know, that the Tokyo Dome main event was Okada's birthright for the next couple of years. So, yeah.
Did you want to go over the possibilities?
I thought you had them. I don't have them on me. There's a lot of them. I mean, simply, the simple one is if Naito wins and Ibushi wins, Naito's going, and Naito's facing Tanahashi in the finals. If Naito loses, then the winner of Tanahashi Ibushi goes to the finals. If Tanahashi and Ibushi draw, then Tanahashi Ibushi,
Omega
and Ibushi draw, then Omega goes. But go through the whole thing because there's like 19 different ways it can go.
All right, I pulled this from the latest issue of the Observer.
Well, but the update's got the better one.
Oh, the update. Today's update.
Today's update's got everything. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Because yeah, I put every possibility down.
All right. Okay, so if Kenny Omega beats Kota Ibushi, he's in the finals no matter what happens with the Naito Sabre Jr. match. If Ibushi beats Omega, then he is in the finals. If Ibushi and Omega go to a 30-minute draw and Naito beats Sabre, Naito is in the finals. If they go to a 30-minute draw and Sabre beats Naito, Omega is in the finals. If there are two 30-minute draws,
which won't happen,
that would be a long night. Omega's in the finals. If Omega and Ibushi go double DQ or double countout and Naito beats Sabre, Naito's in the finals. If Omega and Ibushi do a double DQ or double countout and Naito draws with Sabre, Naito's in the finals. If they do a double DQ and Sabre beats Naito, Omega is in the finals. And if both matches are double DQs, the Tongans can't interfere in both of these matches.
The Tongans can't interfere because that's the part of the show. The Tongans, if they interfere in any matches on tomorrow's show or Sunday's show, they're all suspended for 3 months. So they got their last interference in tonight's show or today's show.
So both matches end up in double DQs. Omega is in the finals, though. Your second one, you said if Ibushi beats Omega, then he is in the finals, but yeah, Naito has to lose.
Naito has to lose to Sabre. Lose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of intrigue because
you don't think that Sabre's beating Naito.
Right.
Now and you don't think there's going to be a 30-minute draw because we already had one today.
But wasn't there also some flip-flopping of what was going to be the main event?
For one day, it was changed to Naito and Sabre, and then at the end of the next morning, it was changed back. It was always Omega Ibushi. Why he was going to change it and then change it back? Does that mean that he's changed his mind? Was that a red herring? It probably wasn't a red herring because they don't think like that. Could it be that they changed the mind? Which would be something. I mean, because usually this stuff is planned out way in advance.
Well, if Naito wins, it essentially makes Ibushi Omega, where Ibushi has to play the spoiler role of his best pal.
Yeah, that's which part of the story.
But if Naito loses, then the drama is about winner take all, which is what it was tonight.
Yeah. Winner take all and the idea that the draw would go to Omega. And I would say if Naito is to lose and Omega and Ibushi were to go, I think that no matter what they do, I think they go past 25 to tease the draw. Because that's part of the drama, is that we're going to get the draw because we're educated to the draw, which means that Omega wins. And based on that, don't you almost go with maybe Ibushi at that point? You know, because, you know, that would be the big pop. And, you know, either way, whether it's Tanahashi Ibushi, Tanahashi Omega, they're both really new, fresh matches. I mean, they have done Tanahashi Ibushi at G1s the last couple of years. But this would still be, you know, it's still a much higher profile than they've done. Tanahashi, like I said, Tanahashi Omega is essentially a fresh match, and that one, if it is Tanahashi Omega, you know, you almost have to go with Tanahashi. But one of the stories in the G1 is Tanahashi You know, I mean, as far as when he wrestled Okada, I mean, it was a clear Tanahashi crowd.
Yeah, I think that's what made that match even more cool is that there was a clear person they wanted to see win that match and move on.
So he's got that sympathy thing down this year. So his beating Omega would be even bigger than Ibushi beating Omega. And beating Tanahashi beating Ibushi as opposed to beating Omega is the bigger story.
Sure.
You know, that's the one that everyone's going to talk about. You know, no matter what, the match is going to be great no matter who's in it, I think, you know, unless somebody breaks their leg. So,
did you want to go over today's show?
Yeah, it was, so it was Tomohiro Ishii and Sho beat Shota Umino and Toa Hinari. That was a good match. It was short, but all four of these guys are good wrestlers. Actually, I think Sho is just tremendous. Hinari is, you know, coming on pretty well. Umino's going to be a superstar, and Ishii is, you know, Ishii's the favorite for MVP, isn't he? You know?
Yeah, you listed in the Observer his big wins from the tournament, and they're all big ones. Like, all his wins were meaningful wins.
He beat every champion, which, you know, again, that's a story, too. The one thing, you know, a lot of the stuff here, when we look back at the tournament, is there was a lot of cool stories. You know, I mean, the Tanahashi going all the way, Omega going unbeaten before losing to Ishii and then getting screwed by the Tongans. The Tongans getting DQ'd all over the place and interfering and all that, whether, you know, it ruined it or not. Jay White, always referee bump, just being a complete asshole. But look at his star status, you know, and in there until the last day. And really good matches. Hangman Page, you know, we've talked about him. Ishii having the incredible matches. Ibushi having the incredible matches. Goto having really good matches, some incredible matches. Elgin having great matches. But, you know, like Page lost a lot, but he got the clean win over Minoru Suzuki. You know, so you had, you know, a lot of that. So, okay, so second match, it's Gedo and Toriano against Tonga and Tangaloa, which as a match completely sucked. The gimmick was that Yano is afraid of the Tongans. Gedo didn't want to wrestle the Tongans. It was a quick match. The Tongans won. Then we had Juice Robinson, David Finley against Hirooki Goto and Yo. And Goto pinned Finley with the GTR. You know, it's fine. It was a five-minute match, so it wasn't. They didn't really have time to do much. Yo's also real. You know, these guys are all pretty talented. Naito and Sonata beat Zack Sabre Jr. and Taka Michinoku. Sonata used a spinning skull end to beat Taka. Short match. Really not much to it. The Young Bucks and Omega against Ibushi, Marty Scurll, and Chase Owens.
Didn't even touch.
It was an incredible something. I thought that, like, okay, they went 5.5 minutes, and they never touched. They did 5.5 minutes of high spots without ever touching. I've never seen anything like it. It was creative as hell. I actually was starting to get into the idea of this is kind of cool. And then the match ended.
I just wanted to see someone punch somebody in the face.
And then you weren't going to get it.
And I didn't get it.
No. Then the Tongans came in and ruined the match, which was like the whole gimmick. Yeah, I mean, like, some people would like the fact that it was entertaining with no one touching, and some people would absolutely hate the match. I mean, it was obviously not designed to be a great match. It's good for Omega and Ibushi. They got a night off, even though, I mean, they took bumps, you know, but you know, it was, I mean, the one thing, it's like Omega just took a hellacious beating in the match with Ishii. So, since then, you know, he had the tag match. He had this match where he didn't do that much. He had the Yano match, which was a pretty easy match, comedy oriented match. You know, so then there's that. Okay, we didn't even talk about the Budokan aspect of the Tanahashi Okada. So, and I didn't really think about this. I mean, one of the things with Makabe and Michael Elgin, Elgin is like. Like, a lot, you know how guys grow up and they want to work Madison Square Garden. Elgin grew up watching those All Japan tapes, you know, that we all watched. So his thing was always working Budokan. And New Japan hasn't worked Budokan in years and years. Mike Logan's never worked Budokan. This is like, this was a real big deal to him. And he also, I don't think, had ever done a singles match with Makabe. And when he was, you know, watching New Japan, you know, Makabe was a pretty big star. So Makabe actually won the match with the, you know, Death Valley driver and the knee drop off the top rope a pretty quick match. I thought the action was real, real good, really hard hitting. So anyway, there's that. Paige and Yoshihashi, which was I thought was really good. Both of these guys, they had their working shoes on, and Yoshihashi won with Karma. I think the idea was that, you know, and this is the same with Elgin and Makabe. I think that the idea is that at the end, they don't want anyone to lose too much face. You know, Makabe's been a big star for years and years and years. They want him to get 6 points. I think that's the reason that he won. And with Yoshihashi and Paige, I think that they just wanted them to be at the same level. So that meant Yoshihashi was going to win that match. Then we had Suzuki and Fale, where, you know, the gimmick is Fale never got pinned the entire G1, which is like the first time anyone's ever done this in a 20-man bracket. But he was DQ'd a million times. So Suzuki had him in the Gotch pile driver. Tama Tonga interfered, hit him with a gun stun. It was a DQ. Until the finish, I thought this match was really good.
I liked it because we didn't have to worry about the stakes. We knew that neither guy was in the mix, and so I wasn't really frustrated with the DQ or with the interference, because it went both ways, and it was fun. I thought the match was fun.
Yeah, I think that it was like, you have Suzuki hitting so hard, but Fale is so big, and Fale would no sell his hits, and then Suzuki would come harder, and it actually was working pretty good. The dynamic was working good. Then Jay White and Evil, which had stakes. Jay White needed a win to stay alive, and Evil beat him with It's Evil, and it went back and forth. And you had all of the stuff with the ref going down and everything, the low blow and the Blade Runner. But when he went for the Blade Runner, Evil turned into Darkness Falls and did the half Nelson German suplex, the hard lariat. Jay came back with, you know, the head and arm back suplex and Kiwi Crusher. I mean, then another ref bump. Jay White went for the chair shot. Evil hit everything as Evil, you know, the STO, threw the chair out of the ring and got the pin. It was good. I mean, not a great match. You live by the sword, die by the sword type of thing, which is, you know, the fitting end of that story. So the other point is, so in the Okada Tanahashi match, I mean, I'm just watching this. Again, there's no super matches on the undercard. They kept the matches short because it was pretty clear they want to keep the show under 3 hours. During the whole tour, they didn't do long shows. You know, everything was kept at the 3 hour range, and I think that was fine. I thought that Budokan, should go four. You know, it'd be interesting to see on Sunday with the finals if they try to keep it to 3 hours. But because, you know, every match was quick, you know, they basically rushed through every match. There was nothing longer than 12 minutes on the card, I don't think. There was nothing over 11 and a half minutes on the whole undercard, you know, and they did the 30-minute main event. But when Tanahashi and Okada started in the first minute, or immediately, really, I never thought about it. And then in the first minute, there was just this crowd reaction, and all of a sudden it hit me. It's like, we're in Budokan. You know, it's like this, you know, which is, it's like a different feel from Sumo Hall. It's a different feel from, Joe Hall in Osaka or Edion Arena in Osaka. It's just different. It has a different look. And, you know, Budokan was the place. I mean, Okada and Tanahashi have never wrestled in Budokan against each other. And it's just the place of, you know, all those classic matches with the Funks and Giant Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta and Misawa Kawada Kobashi. And it was interesting because in that first minute, it just kind of hit me like there was a feel in like Tanahashi Okada is probably the greatest feud of this generation. But you know, there's an aura that Misawa and Kawada and Kobashi matches had in the 90s, and I never thought, as great as these matches were, there was something that those matches had that Tanahashi and Okada never had to me. And the first minute of this match, they had it, and it was Budokan. It was like the sight of the classic match. It's that little special thing, and I never thought about it once. And a minute in the match, it was just like, wow, this is Budokan. This is the crowd reacted like it was an All Japan or a Noah big show sold out main event. They had their favorite. They were into it. And this was not a sold out show like a lot of those shows that I talked about. And they do have the Tonight Show. I mean, you know, the Saturday and the Sunday show are both sold out. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time that any company ever has sold out Budokan two nights in a row. It's never been done before. But they didn't sell it out three nights in a row. This one did not draw big. But it still had that Budokan aura on it.
Where would you put this match on your list of the best matches of the tournament?
Tanahashi Okada? It's tough. It would not be number one. I know people who were there live who said unequivocally it was number one. I think if I was there live, I would. Because didn't you, when you watched it, didn't you have the feeling that this was a match that would really be much better live than the way we were watching it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because there was something about it where I could definitely tell watching it, like, this would be an absolutely phenomenal match live. But let me think about this. I would say 4? Something like that? What would you say? 3?
Probably
or
2 or 3 for me.
Really?
Yeah.
What's number one? Omega Ishii?
I like Omega Naito a little bit better.
Okay.
Omega Ishii and this one are, you know, probably 3. It's probably 3. Because it was so different.
They're all different. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of people still say the Ibushi Ishii, but I, you know, and look, that match was out of this world great, but, you know, there's different types of danger. Omega Ishii was a very physical match, and all that blood on Omega. You know, Omega still got the messed up lip and everything. But look, it's a messed up lip. You know what I mean? I'm not concerned about a messed up lip. And I don't think Omega is concerned about a messed up lip. It's shit happens, right? Ibushi and Ishii, I was just the whole time just worried about everything. We didn't talk about that deal. That the moonsault that he did the other day in Yokohama
wasn't necessary. I think I asked you, I said, this guy's got to have a screw loose because he just wants to do this dangerous thing, which doesn't really mean anything in the match. Looks amazing.
It was phenomenal.
The crowd goes crazy. And it's almost like, oh, I can do this, so I might as well just do it because I can.
And maybe mad because he probably can't do it in Budokan because they'll probably like ban him for life if he does it. Because the story, for some people who don't know, is in 2012, Omega and Ibushi, this is the last time Omega and Ibushi had a singles match. And before the match, I mean, whether they knew that these guys are nuts or what, but they went and told them that you cannot jump off the balcony. So, of course, after being told that, then that balcony is really high. And Ibushi did a moonsault off the balcony and was told that he could never wrestle at Budokan again. But, you know, after 6 years and everything, I guess they rescinded it. But I don't anticipate him doing a moonsault. He may. I mean, because
Well, do you think he'll tease it, at least?
Yes. Yes. I absolutely think he'll tease it. Yes. Don't you?
I mean, I think it makes sense for him to at least tease it.
Oh, it makes sense. Yeah, because it's such a famous spot. But, yeah, the walking on that freaking balanced beam looking thing, right? The handrail. And it's like when he was walking on that handrail, I mean, the only thing is that we watched that, you know, I watched that one, as did you, on tape. So when he's getting up there, if I was watching it live, I would freak.
The first thing that crossed my mind was, oh my God, what is he doing? Wait, if something happened, I would have heard. So I think it's going to be okay.
You're right. Right. My thing was, is like if he broke his neck, I'd already know, you know, and so I guess he came out okay with this. But he's walking on that thing unbalanced. You know, it's like, oh, God, what are you doing? But think about this. Those two guys have saved everything up, both of them, for this match. You know, I mean, this match is the most anticipated match in some ways. You know, I don't want to say more than Omega, you know. I mean, there have been some big anticipated matches this year in New Japan. And again, you know, like Jericho and Naito was real, real big. The Omega Okada match in Osaka with no time in was real, real big. This one's probably number three for the year as far as like anticipated match.
They held it off.
Yeah, because it's been held off for so long. And you know, when Rocky Romero and Kevin Kelly on the broadcast were going, like when Kevin Kelly brought up the quote that Ibushi said, because when Ibushi came back and Omega was finally on top, so they wrestled a couple of times in DDT, in the famous one in 2012. And it was at Budokan, by the way. Yeah, well, obviously, because the moon saw off the balcony. But the whole thing is that Ibushi said, like, he didn't want to do another match with Omega because one of them might die. And Rocky Romero was just like, boy, I hope that doesn't happen. The way he said it was like, and I mean, it's the same thing I'm thinking. It's like, I know. I'm afraid for these guys because I know the lengths, like, whatever those guys both did with Ishii, the bottom line is that they're going to do more in this match than either of them did with Ishii. And the Ibushi-Ishii match was insane.
So speaking of the next shows, we got a lot of wrestling to watch tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why. The MMA fighting guys got me convinced that I got to wake up at 4:30 a.m. to watch the Omega-Ibushi live. But I know you'll watch it in the morning, but yeah. And then we got the Saturday night show because we're on Pacific time. So we can watch it, you know, 11 to 3, maybe two.
Do you think the coming back so soon is going to affect the guys at all?
They do it every year. Omega's, you know, I mean, it should, but look at what Omega's done every year, you know, or everyone, well, you know, it's not just Omega, you know, Naito, the guy who's won the B block. Has, you know, when was the last year we didn't have a great G1 final? I mean, not in this era, you know, maybe back in the Chono era with Chono and Fujita or something, or whatever some of those ones in the past were. But in this Tanahashi era, G1 final is just always a killer match.
All right. So, I guess we can move on to some of the other stuff we want to talk about before we get out of here. You wanted to talk about some of the NXT injuries.
Well, okay, so there's two key things. Okay, so obviously they shot the angle to cover Aleister Black's legitimate injury. So he's out of TakeOver on which is this coming Saturday night. So it's going to be Gargano and Ciampa in a last man standing match. Now, a lot of people know, and some people don't, that Gargano and Ciampa last man standing was what the last TakeOver match in Chicago was supposed to be. But they had all set it up, and then they got the word that Nakamura and AJ were going to do a last man standing match on the main roster, so they were told not to duplicate it. So they just did whatever they did, which was... So this is the match they were actually supposed to do last time anyway. So that's what we got. So it's not going to be a three-way. No Matt Riddle or who was the other guy that people wanted in? Keith Lee.
Well, they're not going to listen to your idea now.
It's too late now. Yeah. So it's just going to be the straight singles. And then Ricochet is fine, pro wrestler fine. He hasn't worked in a while because they wanted him to rest up. If you watch the NXT show that was on Wednesday of this week, they did that big thing where they all beat down Ricochet. That was because he was legitimately injured. And they didn't want him wrestling, so they did the beatdown angle, you know, to explain all that. But he's, I mean, there's no, you know.
What's the injury from?
He did a dive in Paris, and I think he hurt his shoulder. I could be wrong about where it was. I saw the dive. He basically missed a dive, and I think it was the shoulder. And so he worked... one of the England shows, I think, or he worked England. Like, he's worked a couple of matches since then, but it's only like two or three in, you know, since then. And they just wanted him to rest up. And there's no, you know, I mean, as best I can tell, there's no question that he's wrestling Adam Cole. You know, that's not up in doubt. And that he'll be fine for the match with Adam Cole. You know, fine, like I say, fine as in wrestler fine. You know, like, it's like these guys in G1, like, there's probably not one of them who isn't destroyed right now, but they're still going to give you great matches. And Ricochet and Adam Cole, I think that match is going to be fantastic.
You guys talked yesterday about Mae Young Classic stuff. Was there anything else that...
Well, we didn't go over the second day. So it ended up, like we expected, with Io Shirai and Toni Storm are going to be wrestling in the Nassau Coliseum on the All Women's Evolution show. So that match is now official. And the first day was not particularly good from what I heard. The second day I heard was really good. I heard that Toni Storm had one good match after another. The Matsumoto match was good. The Satomura match was good. I mean, like, really good. And Io was pretty much in matches where she was just there to win, and they weren't as good because they were shorter and just more one-sided. So that was kind of the idea, that Io could carry the lesser workers that they needed to go through, and Tony's going to go in there to work with the best people there to have the best matches possible to get to the final. So that was kind of the mentality behind all this. It was interesting because Matsumoto and Satomura kind of have rules when they're booked in Japan. I mean, it's not hard and fast 100%, but that they don't do jobs unless it's their home promotion to build angles for their own promotion. And they both lost here. So some people in Japan were like, wow. But they had to, because there was a tournament. They had to lose. So, but that was interesting. But, yeah, I mean, Toni Storm and Io, realistically, you know, unless the crowd just dies on them because it's Nassau, I don't see a match on that women's show that's going to touch them.
I noticed that Rhea Ripley was the one who went to the semifinals. Tegan Knox hurt her leg in that match.
She broke her leg. Yeah.
Do you think that she was actually supposed to win?
You know, in that match, I don't know who was supposed to win that match. But Tony and Io was. I think I would have heard if that was not going to be the final, and that and Tegan Knox wasn't going to go to the finals anyway, but could she have won that match? Yeah. I should actually ask about that, but that wouldn't surprise me that they had to change that finish. Yeah.
And then there was a note here that Triple H came out and the crowd was chanting.
Oh, sign Mia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mia Yim got over really big. So nobody was signed as of this morning. I heard there may be a couple of people signed off of their performances in here, you know, and when they were chanting sign Mia, he pretty much said yes. So I think Mia Yim is probably getting a deal. So,
and that was one of the big moments of the original Cruiserweight tournament was
Cedric Alexander. Yeah. Yeah. And they tried to do the same thing with Jazzy Gabert, and you know, she'd have been, you know, she was offered a deal. It's just her neck didn't pass. It was really interesting that they did not call Jazzy. I think that for this tournament, I think that it was one of those things where they were concerned probably about her neck and didn't want her going out there and being over, because if she would have been super over.
Yeah.
So, because, yeah, why else would they not call her? She is cleared. She is wrestling now.
You had an update on the UFC buy rate.
300,000. That's the number from Saturday night.
So everyone was low.
Everyone was low, yeah. So I think Cody's that big of a star? Because that's the conclusion. That, you know, in UFC had been telling me that Cody's a big star. And I never saw it. I mean, I don't say I never saw it, because I heard it over and over again. So I it's not like I should be immune from it. But I didn't think that he was a money player. I just didn't. But they sold out Staples Center, which Ronda couldn't even sell at Staples Center. You know, Hoist Gracie and Matt Hughes didn't even come close to selling that Staples Center. You know, I mean, you know, it was a grudge match. Those usually help. And, you know, it's a legitimate grudge match. The guys legitimately hated each other. You know, Demetrius never drew before. And the Cejudo fight was a rematch of a fight that was a first round finish that I didn't hear anyone talking about. I heard people talking. There was nothing on the undercard. It was a two-match show. So I guess, you know, it's too bad. Cody's a draw, and he couldn't win the big one. they gave him two chances. He lost them both. And, you know, Dillashaw is the champ. But I don't know. What did you sense? Because the week before was a bigger show. To me, was a better, much better card, and that did the shits.
I mean, I think people got really into that rivalry. I think that rivalry.
How much do you think the Conor McGregor signing and the Nate Diaz signing had to do with the spy rate?
I mean, focus was back on UFC when it came to, you know, sports news websites.
I know that could be part of it too. But yeah, everybody, I thought, I was on my prediction, 215. And then everybody was saying, you're way too high. And I thought, 215. It's two title matches and it's a legit grudge. I thought 215. But yeah, they did real well.
I read in the Observer you had the weights of the guys, when they rehydrated. TJ came in a lot higher than Cody, right?
Yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think TJ was like 149.5, and I think Cody was 142. I mean, Cody was the same as Demetrius Johnson and Henry Cejudo.
And that made me wonder if he could fight at the lower weight.
I think he could. Everybody else cuts 17 pounds. I mean, yeah. There was a guy, what was it? I'm trying to remember. I was reading about a guy who cut like 40 pounds. There was a story on MMA fighting. I think it was Drew Dober, maybe. But he was like, it was just a ridiculous amount of weight that he cut. Yeah.
Wow. 40 pounds.
It may not be 40, but it was like way over. It was like check MMA fighting.
What was his normal weight?
He fought at 155, and I think that he was like some like between 185 and 190. He was bigger than George St. Pierre. I remember that number, that he's bigger than George St. Pierre, and he fought at 155.
So it says that – actually, that's the wrong website. So it says that he got cleared to fight at lightweight. He's fine to continue his career at 155. It doesn't say what his
it's in there for sure.
He weighed 183 on fight night at UFC 214. Was 18% above the lightweight limit. CSAC regulations state that any fighter who comes into the fight night weighing more than 10%
above.
Yeah, but
everyone was over 10% this on Saturday, except for like three or four guys. So he was 183, and he was fighting at 155. So that's 28 pounds that he cut. But, yeah, so.
All right, so let's see. Last thing on my list to talk about is, and you'll have to tell me why we're talking about this, which is the TNA and Spike, the history of that whole thing and how it went down.
Yeah, it's just something that we got up on Twitter. So the basic situation is this.
People were tweeting you about this thing that happened years ago.
Yeah, over and over and over again, and thinking I don't know what I'm talking about. And I know, unfortunately, it's one of those stories that I know way too well. So what happened, okay, the Impact's ratings were falling the last year, and they were certainly, there were things with Impact that made them unhappy. And, you know, they certainly hated Vince Russo.
You're talking about Spike TV.
Spike TV, yeah. So, there was certainly talk of dropping Impact before the deal happened with Russo. Okay, it wasn't like it's 100% because of that, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So what happened was, Vince Russo was secretly working. They were all denying it. I remember watching, going like, I see too many Russo fingerprints on this, and it was always denied to me. And I wasn't the only one. There were other reporters who, you know what a Russo show looks like, and said that. And
so we were just all, for the people who may be listening, you know, for the first time, being that this is a free show, Spike didn't want Russo.
No. The reason that the Russo thing was a secret was because Spike was adamant that they didn't want Vince Russo anywhere near the product. Whatever it was, I don't know what the reason is, but you know, Spike hated Vince Russo. Okay. As far, you know, and again, I can see why, because, you know, Dixie may have been charmed by him, but anyone who had any knowledge of wrestling, you know, and saw WCW or saw the garbage that he did in Impact, you know what I mean? It's just like, whatever, you know, it's, there's a track record there and it's pretty bad. So, no, yeah, they didn't want it. So Dixie, in her infinite whatever, hired Russo back. But the whole thing was you got to keep it a secret, because if Spike finds out, you know, they're going to be really upset because they said no. So Dixie felt they needed Russo. So I remember watching stuff. I was talking to people who knew that he was there, and they wouldn't tell me, but but the wrestlers didn't know. But there are people who, there were, you know, five or six people probably were new. Maybe that many. So he was doing a thing, and he sent, you know, he would send emails to Mike Tenay and Taz, the announcers, tell them, you know, how to call things and what to do and all that. So there was this day, and they're in the office ready to do voiceovers, and Taz has his email from Vince Russo, and Mike Tenay is there, and he doesn't have his email from Vince Russo. And he's going like, that's weird. Why don't I have my email from Vince Russo? So he looks at Taz's, and he looks at like where it's sent to, and there's no Mike Tenay. It says Mike Johnson. So that's when they go, oh my God, Vince Russo accidentally emailed Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson, writer for Pro Wrestling Insider. So Mike Johnson knows 100% that Vince Russo's there. That's the smoking gun. So in their infinite wisdom, so they go to John Gaborik, who was the head of the company at the time. I don't know where Dixie was, but this is John Gaborik's thing. We got a problem here. So in their infinite wisdom, nobody calls Mike Johnson. And the big question that we all have is, and the only person who can answer this question is Mike Johnson. I've never asked him this. And maybe I should have, but it, in the end, it didn't matter. But I was always curious that what if John Gaborik called Mike Johnson and goes, Mike, we know you know, but we're fucked. You know what I mean? Because if Spike finds out, and you write this and Spike finds out, we're fucked. We're fucked bad. So please don't report it. Okay, they never made that call. If it was me and I'm in John Gaborik's shoes, that's the first thing I do. You may not, you know, he may say no. Hey, I got a story, and you lied, and you're fucked, and fuck you. You know, I mean, he may just go, well, okay, I don't want you to lose TV. I don't want to hurt the business, and he may have said, okay, they did not make that, but I would certainly have made the call. I mean, wouldn't that be the first person you would call? Is Mike Johnson?
Absolutely.
They didn't call. They called Vince Russo, and they couldn't get a hold of him. I guess, why would you call Vince Russo? So Vince Russo, who they can't get a hold of, then Vince Russo is, of course, in the middle of this, and he's going in there saying, Mike Johnson's a liar, you were worked, he's a fraud, he's doing all this. He just goes through this whole thing. And Mike Johnson's all, look, he's got the evidence. It's like me with the Destination America thing, and also with the Spike thing, both those things, where everyone's calling me a fraud, and it's like, hey, I know the story. Go call me a fraud, because in the end, and speaking of which, do you know how many people owe me apologies for that? For both of those, for the Spike and the Destination America. And I told them, and it's like, those fuck those people. No, realistically, fuck them. Because again, so anyway, so I know. So okay, so this goes down. So Russo's lying about it left and right, and you know, you're worked, and Mike Johnson's a fraud, and blah blah blah. And Mike's just completely calm, because of course, in that situation, that's what you do. You go like, I got the evidence.
Yeah,
you know. So that only makes it worse, because they're going back and forth, And the truth's going to come out, and he's making it worse. And frickin' Gaborik, who doesn't get a hold of Russo, finally gets hold of Russo and goes, Russo, you got to tell the truth, because he already knows the truth. So then Russo has to do this one. Well, they told me to lie, and it's all their fault and all this. So that's what happened. But, of course, the end result is we all know, okay, because Mike Johnson reported it, and he had the evidence, and Spike knew, and they got canceled. It was not 100% that why they got canceled, but that was they got canceled literally days after. It came out like 2 weeks after. I knew that they were canceled, I would say a couple of days. I had gotten tip, but it was essentially one person told me, but it's like this is like your third hand stuff, right? You know, I mean, it was actually second hand. But it's like I knew it was true, but I can't go with it on such a big story. Then I got it confirmed, but the person who told me to confirm, you know, confirmed it, which was like a day later, and she said, this is off the record. So I'm sitting there. Brian knew, I knew. I can't go with this story, but I know it's true. So I'm sitting there going like, yeah, so I won't break the story. Someone's getting it within a day. Mm-hmm. You know, this is pro wrestling, right? I sat there for like a freaking week, and I'm hinting to people, and but I can't do it. So finally, of all people, you know, and you know, again, it's Ryan Satin. But I was tell you, here's the funny part of the story is, so right, so this is about a week later, and I'm just waiting for somebody break this story. It's a huge story. They're getting canceled by Spike, you know, and we can talk about it. I can talk about it with Brian, but we can't talk about it. So, and I'm not going to be able to, you know what I mean? So, but someone's got it, right? So finally, I get a phone call from Court Bauer. And he goes, have you heard anything about Spike canceling TNA? And I don't even remember what I told him, but I probably told him yes. Because, yeah, but I mean, he was not a reporter at that time. But he was, you know, Court's a guy who I know. I said yes. So evidently, Ryan Satin, and I actually, even though I haven't spoken to Ryan Satin in a long time, even though we go to PWG and we see each other every show and we maybe sometimes say hi and often don't even say that. But at the time, I actually had met Ryan Satin at a WWE function, and we talked about like how we both found out about it. And he had his sources at Spike, like I did. And he knew 100% that it was true. But for whatever reason, he talked to Court. And Court may very well have told him, you know, yes, it's true, or maybe, I don't know what Court told him, but whatever. So these guys, so he breaks the story, and a minute later, you know, Court is telling me he's breaking the story. It's like, that's fine, because then I can write my real story, because I know everything that had happened, you know, everything that actually went down, and he only knows that they're canceled. So fine, go break the story. You know, that's cool by me. So, so immediately, which was funny, is, and I don't remember if this was Shearer or Mike Johnson, and I don't talk to those guys or email them often. There are occasions where I do, okay? But they emailed, and so Ryan Satin breaks the story. And then I immediately break the story too and just go like, this is true and this is what happened and me and Brian talk about. And they go, Dave, oh, you know, Court Bauer made this story up and he told Ryan Satin and he went with it and there's no truth to it. And I emailed them both back or whichever one. I can't say both. I don't remember. I think it was Shear. I don't think it was Mike. Mm-hmm. But it was one of the two. It was Pro PW Insider. And I go, no. I go, I promise you the story's true. They didn't believe me, of course. And I go, I promise you it's true. I'm just telling you. It's true. They didn't believe me. And they spent months with the idea that, you know, that it's just a negotiation thing and they're still going back and forth. They were never going back and forth. It was already done. It was a done deal. They didn't announce it for months because Spike didn't want people to know for 6 months, you know, that this is a lame duck show. You don't want to say that publicly. That's how you work things. But even so, I mean, it was the same people who were making speeches or going like, well, you know, we're in discussion. It's not a done deal. Had already told me that it's done. So that was the story, you know, that was the story as far as how that one went down. But it was, you know, I mean, that's what it was.
Someone just tweeted you today about this, and is that why it came back up?
I'm trying to remember, but it was somebody who didn't believe that version of the story. And then Velvet Sky came and said, "Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I was there." And it was because they hated Dixie. And it's like, you know, did they hate Dixie? Probably, you know, probably by the end they did, you know, but that's what happened. She, you know, it was weird because at first it's like she's sort of attacking me and I'm going like, well, you know what you know. You know, were you in that? In, you know, do you know the blow by blow what happened that day? Probably not. I don't know. I know too many people do, but whatever. It's fine. You know, go with your thing. And the reality is that, you know, her version of the story isn't untrue. They were tired of Dixie and the ratings were falling. You know, that it wasn't just this one thing. It was that was just the last straw. And if it didn't happen, they may have been canceled. They may not have been canceled if it didn't happen. We don't know. But once, look, they're mad at Dixie because she lied to them saying, you know, so essentially it is Dixie's fault. I never said it was Russo's fault. I said, you know, and people are attacking me going like, oh, that sounds like it's Dixie's fault. And it's like, well, hell, of course it was Dixie's fault. You know, I mean, it wasn't Russo's fault. They just hated Russo because they understood that Russo was really bad at his job and they didn't want him involved, you know, on the show that they were doing for whatever reason. So, but then, like, I think later I could kind of see that her whole thing was like, I'm agreeing with her and she's going, oh, you're still picking on Russo. And it's like, I could just see that it's like, for whatever reason, she just wants to defend Russo. And there's no defense. This story doesn't defend Russo. You know what I mean? It's like, so I was like, okay, I see through this. It's like, forget this.
Sometimes your Twitter feed is a sort of a who's who about insecurity in wrestling sometimes.
Well, you know, so the one thing that I have learned, and everyone should learn, that we got the buzzwords, right? It's like, if you call someone who's using the word mark, in almost, 95% of the cases, they're idiots, okay? Smark, probably about 98%.
Or they just hear this terminology, and they don't really know what any of it means.
Yeah. Dirt sheet, what do you say, 85, 90%? Maybe more? So, I mean, I look at those, when I see those words and I kind of make fun of people, I go, okay, these are the idiot words. So the biggest idiot, the new idiot word is I was there. Because everyone who does I was there, they're fucking liars in every case. Because, you know, you weren't there and I was there. It's like, in most cases, I know more than you do in most cases about what's going on behind the scenes when it comes to business. And even if I don't, when you're pulling that card, in almost every case, you're lying. I mean, it's like every time you see a guy do the I was there thing, how many times have they been honest? Do you ever see it?
I don't see it that often. You obviously see it way more than I do, but the way I see it is reading your Twitter feed.
Yeah. So that's the situation. That's what brought up the thing. So I told people, I go like, I'm going to tell the story of that one. Do we have time? Can I tell the Destination America story too? Because actually I like that story too.
I think we have a couple minutes.
Okay. So this is Destination America. This is a year later, Destination America. So there's I got the memo, right? You know that. Mm-hmm. I got the memo of Destination America informing their employees we're canceling Impact. Okay. And so the situation there, as soon as I knew they had buyer's remorse. Oh God, right away. You know, I mean, there were one thing after another. They were canceling programming and things like that. Whatever they had paid, they got buyer's remorse. They thought, you know, I think they thought that this show was doing 1 million viewers on Spike. We're going to get this show to 1 million viewers. And they were doing, 300,000 viewers. So it's like, oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? We're paying money. Cause they actually pay, unlike with Pop, which is paying, you know, basically nothing for the show. Destination America was paying, they weren't paying close to what Spike was paying, but they were paying real money. And they're not getting the numbers that they expected. So, you know, and the ad, you know, so anyway, they decide they're going to cancel the show. So the first thing I do, this was on a Tuesday. So I was like, I email Dixie. I email Dixie and I go, I don't know if you know this, but I'm just telling you that you're getting canceled and, you know, the thing with Dixie up to that point. So I have to explain this part of it. Before that, I would say that when it comes to over the years, if I would email Dixie, I would say 90 to 95% of the time I would hear back immediately. And one time, I want to say this too, okay, there was a charity situation, and I emailed UFC, WWE, and Dixie, one right after the other, you know, get involved. And just Dixie, I mean, within 5 minutes, immediately. The other ones, not at all, okay? Dixie immediately, you know, so whatever, okay? I just want to point that out to give a good side of that. So I email her, and it's like, okay, it's Tuesday. I'm on deadline. She's probably not going to get back to me. Unlike with the other one, my gamble was that I don't think anyone's going to get this story. With the Spike one, I kept hoping they would. After the Spike one, where it took so long, I'm going like, I don't think anyone's going to get it. So I'm going to wait till the next Tuesday, and I'm going to do the story the next Tuesday. She'll have time. She can do what she can do, you know, alert people, whatever. And, you know, I will report it the next Tuesday with comments, figuring I'm going to get comments from her.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't hear from her at all. So, which surprised me. I figured I would get comments, and I have the story, and she could say what she needs to say. So I don't hear from her at all. And then they know I'm doing the story the next week, obviously. So I start getting attacked by their different people. Dave Meltzer has no credibility, blah, blah, blah. Wow, you're going to play this game. So it's like, okay, you're going to play this game. That's fine. You know, I'm making it up. He's a liar. He's going to make, you know, he makes up stories about us. It's what the game you want to play. Okay, so either way, even if they said anything, the next Tuesday I'm writing the story. So the timing, just to tell you the part. So I had booked for guests for our show, Mike Tenay and Kurt Angle for that week. And Kurt and I had, you know, Kurt was going to do it on the Foxcatcher thing on Dave Schultz, his mentor. And, you know, it was literally months he'd agreed to do it. And Kurt just kept putting off watching the movie, because if you're Kurt Angle, you know, like he knew he had to see the movie.
It's a tough one to watch.
Like, what, you know, like I remember, you know, the when Mike Tenay went in there on the show where he did the interview with Kurt on the movie, and he just goes, what's it like going to a movie when it's a movie about your best friend and you know at the end of the movie he dies, you know? And it's like, so Kurt was like avoiding it because he knew it was going to be a bad deal for him. So he finally watched it. He's ready to do the show. And Mike, Mike has ever done a show for our website. And I finally convinced him, you know, just do one show. You know, Mike's probably one of the most knowledgeable people in wrestling in the world. And, you know, whatever he was, you know, he agreed. So this happened. So I go, it's going to be bad. And I think I owe it. So, I mean, I email Dixie. I email Kurt. I email Mike. Dixie first, then probably Mike, and then Kurt. But all right after the other, one after the other. And I go, look, this is the situation. You're getting canceled. It's going to come out in a week. And for your goodness of your career, decide, you know, I would suggest you don't do the show. But if you want to do it, I'll do it with you. I'm not going to cancel you. It's your call. And they both said, yeah, this probably isn't the week to do the show.
Yeah.
And so they didn't do the show. And, you know, and Mike never agreed to do the show again. And now he doesn't want to do podcasts. And, you know, Kurt, you know, whatever. You know, the time came and went. And, you know, and then he went to WWE. So it's too bad, because they would have been two phenomenal shows. And so anyway, that was the story.
And if anybody listening wants to write to the death of TNA, they have like the last five chapters, right? Just listen to the podcast.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I'm sure that a lot of people are going to be really unhappy about some of this, but that's exactly the chronology of how everything went down.
TNA is not dead. I was just joking.
No, actually, they're more entertaining than they've been. But God, the rating that they had this week was very scary. But it's a 1 week thing. I always say that, like, don't freak out over 1 week rating. But if this becomes a pattern, it's really too bad, because you know, they've some of the stuff they got. You know, freaking LAX is tearing it up. They had LAX and Chris Brooks and Jonathan Gresham in New York the other night. I heard people were just saying it was like the best tag match they've seen live in a long, long time. So those guys are doing great, and the last pay-per-view was very strong. And what was it? There's Thursday show, this coming Thursday show, there's a street fight where they actually do a street fight, you know, with it was LAX and Homicide and Hernandez. And I heard that visually, I mean, it's not in the ring. It's like they do a street fight in the street.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which I heard. I heard when it was filmed that it was phenomenal. And then somebody had told me who actually just saw the finished product of how it looks going to look on TV on Thursday and said, you just got to see it. So I guess another thing to look forward to this week besides the G1 finals, Kota Ibushi and Kenny Omega, NXT TakeOver, that's going to be probably the best TakeOver show ever, and SummerSlam, which is going to be 6 long hours, and hopefully some good matches, but you know, yeah, a lot of big stuff.
So you and Brian will be back after the G1 finale?
We'll be back on Sunday morning. We're not going to go right after the show.
That's probably for the best.
Yeah, really. But yeah, so we'll have a lot to talk about.
All right, that wraps it up here. Thanks for listening, and look for the show on Sunday with Brian and Dave.